welcome to the Brandel Chamblee podcast. I'm Jaime Diaz. Brandel, great to have you again. It's been a while, but a lot of stuff's happened. The most immediate
thing. Yeah, nice to see you.
Nice to see you, Jaime.
It's always nice talking to you.
Likewise. And we're coming off the Olympics, I guess, most immediately. And, you know, that was quite a spectacle. Of course, we were covering it from, you know, the early mornings in Stanford. But I think we got a good sense of its import and its, I think, atmosphere there. How do you feel about the Olympics? Was it a net gain for golf? Did Tokyo help the game?
Oh, I think so. I think it would have brought golf into the homes of, you know, millions of people around the globe who otherwise might not have been interested. You know, I thought we had some fantastic global performances there. Of course, you know, notable performances by Nelly and Xander Schauffele, but to see CT Pan play so well, Monet and Anami play so well, I thought was was a bit of a surprise to see Aditi Ashok, just miss a medal. But you know, when you think about where she came from, how few golfers there are in India, how few golf courses there are, and the possibility of her presence on that leaderboard and almost on that podium, and the implications of that, I think, are who knows, maybe 5-10 years down the road, we will see that. But the fact that Aditi Ashok, to me, she was, you know, okay, sure, Nelly and Xander Schauffele were the stars of golf in the Olympics, but Aditi Ashok was one of the more pleasant surprises, I think.
Yeah, Aditi Ashok, in a way, is the main narrative of why we have the Olympics. A prototype of
yeah, good
example.
Point. Yeah,
yeah, which is great. But I did think that Xander and Nelly's obvious emotion and appreciation for that moment elevates the gold medal even more. I mean, Justin Rose had that in Rio. And I think it really does come down to how much the players care. And I think it took a step up, even though the pandemic was definitely hampering the Tokyo Games. I think that the way the players took to the Olympics, Rory also changing his impressions of the importance of them. I think that was all a real net gain. Just about going forward, would you prefer any changes in the format or how golf is presented in the Olympics?
Well, I wouldn't. You saw the typical and predictable Twitter bluster, but that's almost everybody who was making those remarks on Twitter can be found making those similar remarks almost every weekend. they're not happy with it. They want it to be a team event. A team event is a different concept. The way I understand it is, you know, you can't have a team event run concurrently with an individual event. They have to be separate. So. And you want to, you know, be very clear about what you're asking of the Olympics. Are you asking, or, you know, who comes together the best as a team, or you're trying to identify who is the very best player that week? I think the individual format, although maybe it was a bit slow in the early process, the fact that people didn't know the golf course, they didn't know what to expect on the golf course, and tournaments take a little while to gain momentum. You know, and there was no crowds on site, so you didn't have crowd noise in the background that certainly has an effect on the viewing experience at home. But I was quite fine with the way the event played out personally.
Yeah, I like 72 holes of medal play. I know that is considered kind of outdated or not innovative, but it's the ultimate test. And at the end, it was quite exciting to have the playoffs for the medals. And I just think that, you know, it's the simplest way to present the international game, because theoretically, every country who's in the Olympics has a chance to be seen on television for 4 days, which would not be the case if it were match play. And it would be too hard, I think, to have a team event, because you'd have to have equal numbers of players on each team, probably limiting that down to two. And then you'd keep a lot of great players from America and other, you know, golf-rich countries. Out of the game. So it's a practical, I think, decision that has been well thought out, and it works for me. So
I saw some people suggesting match play. You know, a match play is no way to decide who the best player is that week. It's it's entertaining for sure, the do or die nature of it, but it is far from the best way to decide who plays the best golf over a particular week. And when you're talking about a gold medal, something as significant of medaling, I think the goal would be to find out who competed the best that week. Match play would be, I think a horrible way to go about things, to serve the entertainment needs of a few people watching. It's like, why are you watching the Olympics? To be entertained or to find out who the very best athlete is that particular week in that particular event, which medal play does.
And as we know, match play often falls flat as entertainment because too many, top players get eliminated early and suddenly tournaments lose star power and matches are lopsided. There's a lot of, I love match play when it's optimum, but it's not always optimum. Anyway, that's good. I think we give an A to the Olympics, and that's good for the game, I think, going forward. Let's talk about Nelly Korda. Brantley, you've seen so many great players. One of your great strengths is, placing players in historical perspective. Obviously, it's very early for Nelly, but she's off to a wonderful start, and she seems to have a tremendous foundation in terms of her abilities. Where do you think she is, and where do you see her going?
Well, I think the U.S. has missed out on having a dominant player for, the better part of 30 years, really. You have to go back to, I think, when you look at what Nelly Korda is capable of doing the rest of this year, you have to go back to sort of Beth Daniels, 1990. I think she won seven times, to look for a corresponding season from an American player on the LPGA Tour. Annika Swornstam came along in the mid-90s, and then Kari Webb came along, Lorena Ochoa came along. They dominated, and by dominate, I mean had an extended run more than 2 years, an extended run, 3, 4, 5, 6 in Annika's place, the better part of 15 years. There hasn't been, I know Christy Kerr got to number one. I know Stacey Lewis got to number one, but their runs were, in terms of dominance, I don't think you'd call either of those runs dominant. You'd call them nice runs and great play, and they're certainly exciting, but in terms of winning 6, 7, 8 events in a year, you have to go back start talking about Beth Daniels and Patty Sheehan, Joanne Carner, and Nancy Lopez. And I think the United States has missed that dominant player. It looked like it was going to be Michelle Wee. That didn't materialize. It looked like it was going to be Lexi Thompson. That didn't really materialize. It looked like it was going to be Paula Creamer. That didn't materialize. It looked like it might be Morgan Pressel. That didn't materialize. All of them for different reasons, lack of power or lack of touch or, too many injuries have beset all of these players. As I said, Stacey Lewis and Christy Kerr played some remarkable golf. Matter of fact, there's a fellow that I know I've talked about this man quite a bit, but it's worth noting that in the book, The Whole Truth, a fellow by the name of Bill Felber wrote that book. He's a sabermetrics fellow. And he applied standard deviation to every single major championship that had ever been played. And the most dominant performance in any major championship, by his estimation, by standard deviation, was not Tiger Woods at the 2000 U.S. Open. That was second. That was second to Christy Kerr's LPGA victory, if they win by 12 shots. I realize Tiger Woods won by a wider margin, but in terms of the entire field, Christy Kerr's performance was the more dominant. The single most dominant performance in the history of major championships was by Christy Kerr. And I think that's an underappreciated fact. I certainly talk about it as often as it's relevant to what we're talking about. But yes, there's been some notable moments from players from the United States on the LPGA Tour and the global women's game. But I think Nelly Korda has all of the potential to go on and have a sustained dominant run, which would be which would be great. I mean, purses on the LPGA Tour this year were approaching $80 million. And of course, with news of the Women's Open, the AIG Women's Open, increasing their purse, this is good news to see a player who's so exciting, but also has power, also has massive appeal, come along is great just for the entire game in general, but specifically the LPGA Tour.
Yeah, you know, I'm so impressed with Nelly, and she is a bit of a throwback in the sense of being this tall, statuesque, wonderful technique. It reminds me a little, in terms of style with Mickey Wright, who, you know, to some people had the model swing, Ben Hogan included. Always cited what incredible, sort of grace and solid fundamentals that she had. Beth Daniel was in that category too, I think, and used to hear when Beth was at her best in her early 90s, during the 80s, that she was sort of someone who was picking up where Mickey Wright left off. And so that's something that I think separates Nelly from the other American number ones. And I think it's great that you've given credit to Christy Kerr for what she did, because she really was an incredible competitor, could get off on great ball striking runs, but was always a good putter. So she doesn't always get the credit, but probably lacked the length to be as dominant. And certainly Nelly does have that kind of length. So all these things just make it an interesting time in LPGA history, because the South Koreans have dominated. Rightfully so, they've outworked and probably out-techniqued the Americans for a while here. But there seems to be a little bit of a lull in their moment. And Nelly is filling the vacuum right now. Not a vacuum, but certainly taking advantage of a slight gap. So,
yeah, well, I mean, Nelly comes along with, you know, it's been a while since power dominated on the LPGA Tour. Although Yanni Sin had a run, but it was a brief run, and it was an incredible run.
Yeah,
but Lydia Ko and Envy Park haven't been dominating with power. Lorena Ochoa did. Certainly, Kari Webb had plenty of power, and Annika Sorenstam did. But when you see someone come along with every facet of the game the way Nelly Korda does, and I would agree with you, her golf swing, you know, it's hard to find its equal in the world of golf today, anywhere on the landscape, male or female. And her transition, her backswing, and then her transition from backswing to downswing is as good as I've ever seen. You'd be hard pressed to find anything better anywhere in the annals of golf. And you're right. I mean, Beth Daniels certainly did have an amazing golf swing. And it's when I look at Nelly Korda, I kind of see Beth Daniel. And from a technical standpoint, yeah, I do. I think there's some Mickey Wright in there as well.
Well, okay, that's great. Let's move on to the playoffs, the FedEx playoffs, which we're in the midst of right now. Very often, the player of the year is determined by many things, obviously majors mostly, but the FedEx playoff can be the tiebreaker and kind of the determiner. What do you see right now as the player of the year, and who would you still put in the mix depending on how they play at the FedEx playoffs?
Well, Colin Morikawa and John Rahm seem to me to be, you know, the obvious choices that are, you know, by far and away, I think, the two obvious candidates. So I think you have that sort of heat through the playoffs. They have, you know, three events to sort of distinguish themselves. It's unfortunate that Rahm's dominant performance at Memorial was cut short by a positive COVID diagnosis, because I think that would have been enough to really put them neck and neck. I mean, right now I'd say, you know, maybe Colin Morikawa is you know, perhaps got his nose in front. But as we, you know, as we go into the FedEx Cup, I have been from day one laudatory about what the FedEx Cup does. It brings the best players in the world together for, you know, almost a month straight of, you know, highly competitive golf late in the year, you know, after the major championships have been played. So it brings a wonderful conclusion to the year. And all you need to do is go back and compare the ratings of the finishing events in 2006 to 2007, 8, 9, 10, 11. You can see that the viewership was up by about a third the last time I looked. So, you know, I'm looking forward to it. You know, DJ is not in the best of spots starting the FedEx Cup to become the first player, as hard as it is to believe, that it is successfully defended. He's in 17th spot heading into the FedEx Cup, although he was in 15th spot last year heading into the FedEx Cup before he went on to win the whole thing. So he's in a similar spot. I'd be curious to see if he can sort of summon the game that he had last year. I thought Rory, I'm looking forward to watching Rory play because it looked like his ball striking turned a bit of a corner. The last few times I've seen him, I think the Olympics was a good spot for him. I think he went over there and was able to sort of get free of the disentangle himself from the overly technical thoughts that were being thrown at him by Pete Cowan. You know, not a fan of the work they've put forth. And I felt like Rory was able to clear his head at the Olympics, swing with a little bit more freedom. And I think that showed up at Memphis, where he had every facet of the game. It was probably his best week ball striking. So I'd like to see, you know, I'm really looking forward to watching Rory compete through the FedEx Cup and see if he can sort of find that form that really has been missing to some extent since he came back from the pandemic.
Well, that would be exciting because Rory did a couple of years ago, you know, capture the FedEx Cup, and it really capped his year. And of course, he didn't really build on it the next year because he has been in a bit of a lull that's been a little, you know, mysterious to some extent. But, you know, it's, you know, just like with DJ, the ability is there. And DJ clicked in last year and, you know, he won this thing, the Northern Trust, by 11 shots. That was one of the, you know, great post Tiger kind of, you know, overwhelming victories on the PGA Tour in recent years. So, you know, I think there's a lot that could happen at the FedEx Cup. I think anybody who's won a major who happens to win the FedEx Cup would probably be player of the year, you know, and that might even include Bryson, who gets, I don't think so, but I mean, he has two victories if you count the US Open and Bay Hill. And if he were to win the FedEx Cup, that would be a pretty good case. And Justin Thomas with a Players' Championship, if he were to win the FedEx Cup, he would be in the conversation, I think. So, you know, a lot can happen. I think that's the whole point of the FedEx Cup, is to bring things to a head and get people talking about golf at a time right before football, where there should be a culmination. I agree with you on your assessment of the FedEx. Hey, I'm just curious, you know, we're at Carnoustie this year for the AIG Women's Open. I happen to love Carnoustie, and I've been fortunate, as I know you have, to play a lot of links courses over there. I think hole for hole, it's actually my favorite in terms of sort of the interest that it brings to the shots it asks you to hit. I mean, St. Andrews is always the most romantic and I love it the most, but just in terms of golf, I kind of like Carnoustie the best. And that's probably a minority view, but I love the finish and I love the rounds I've had there, I guess. What's your, you're now an architect and I'm probably more interested than ever in the great old courses. What's your view of the Rota courses and which ones are your favorite?
Well, you know, it's funny. My architect partner, Augustine Pisa, I just call him Augie. You know, he reminds me of Ben Crenshaw a lot. He's got a real artistic nature about him. And he always talks about, and he's brought me along for the ride on this, the carousel of emotions, which is really important in the flow of a golf course. And that is what I love about St. Andrews, is that it does take you on this carousel of emotions where, you know, it sort of builds to this crescendo. And then it, you know, it has this, you know, very serene moment as it finishes on the 18th hole, with plenty of opportunity there, you know, for advancement and very little for catastrophe at the 18th hole. But nonetheless, it's there. What I love about Carnoustie is, and I wouldn't describe it as taking you on this carousel of emotions quite as clearly as, say, Muirfield or St. Andrews. It's a brutal test, and it finishes brutally. You'd be hard-pressed to find another golf course anywhere in the landscape of professional golf that finishes with four harder holes. The 15th, you know, it's a hard fairway to hit. Fairway slopes left to right. You got to thread the eye of the needle with your approach shot. You got to cross the burn a couple times at 17 and avoid the burn a couple times at 18. with out of bounds just to the left of the hole. It's certainly a compelling golf course. I spent the summer there when I was in college, not at Carnoustie, but in Scotland. And, you know, so I'm not as familiar. We played a lot of different golf courses, but only once at Carnoustie. So I'm not as familiar with Carnoustie as I am with some of the other venues. It certainly has the respect of the players. It will forever be associated with perhaps the greatest ball striker of all time, Ben Hogan. His victory there in 1953, it will forever be associated with the catastrophe that happened there with John Vandeveld. But I think more importantly, I think it's tremendous. I think that the women are playing some compelling and historic golf courses, because as they say, the venues do matter. And they certainly do. You know, I can't wait to see this event unfold. Wouldn't it be nice to see, you know, a closely contested event with three or four players coming to the 18th hole and having to play that with their nerve endings on fire and all of us on the edge of our seats. So, I think from that aspect, it's a great watch. But if I had my druthers over there and you said you can play two golf courses, let's say in Scotland, of course you're going to go to St. Andrews, and some would go to Carnoustie. And I might, if I was feeling froggy and pretty strong about my game, but otherwise I go to Muirfield.
Yeah, it's an embarrassment of riches over there. And I agree. I mean, Carnoustie doesn't have sort of the outward charm. It's kind of not just brutal finish, but it's sort of a Spartan gray atmosphere there too. But I've always loved playing there. I'm not that good a player, but I just feel like, wow, you know, this is really the course that hole after hole, you got to think and hit shots in a way that is a little more elevated than the other places to me, even though so many of them are more scenic. I mean, Turnberry is incredibly beautiful. Birkdale too. I mean, you can't go wrong, but I like Carnoustie getting on the main stage and getting appreciation, because I do think it's a little underrated as a place that really is about pure golf. It's kind of like Bandon Dunes. I love Bandon Trails, and it's the only one not on the ocean, but it is the course, I think, hole for hole with Kirk Crenshaw's, you know, genius that just makes you put you into the game more than the other courses, even though those courses are on classic, you know, oceanside venues.
Yeah. I think Bandon Trails, I share that view with you. I think what's great about Bandon Trails is that it does take you on that carousel of emotions. It does tease you with holes. It allows you to have some fun. It allows you to get excited. It makes you think you're going to conquer things. And then, you know, the next thing you know, you've pitched it into a bunker from 40 yards away, or, you know, and then you feel like a complete and utter fool. There's this ebbing and flowing of a round of golf and your emotions as the day goes on. So, you know, that's, I think, one of the things that Ben Crenshaw and Core, they capture. They get that golf is meant to be fun, and it's meant to take you on this wonderful emotional ride.
Thank you. And, you know, finally, you know, the next time we talk, the Ryder Cup will have been played, and we're less than a month away. And I just wonder, it's still in a formative stage because the teams aren't picked, and Steve Stricker's got 6 picks. But what are your thoughts coming to this Ryder Cup? Obviously, there's a COVID aspect to it at this time that's been undecided. It's sort of out there hanging in the little bit of limbo as far as how it's going to be played. But do you feel like this one has any special kind of allure to you as far as what's interesting about it?
I think the Ryder Cups are always compelling, you know, because, you know, consistently, not always, but consistently, the U.S. goes in the favorite, and consistently, not always, they get their hat handed to them. I think it's one of the more fascinating events in all the sport for that very reason. You know, we have talked ad nauseum. I don't even know how many hours we would have talked about the inability of the U.S. team to come together. But I think more than that, it's it's the ability of the European team. Because when we talk about the inability of the U.S. team to come together, like, well, they don't have any problem coming together in the President's Cup. It's just the ability of the European team to come together, to rally around their captain, whoever it is, whatever decisions he makes. There just seems to be a greater unity there. And even though I feel like, and I could be dead wrong on this, but I feel like the captaincy, the European captaincy is, it's no doubt that captain talks to everybody on the team. I've talked to McGinley a fair bit about his captaincy role, but it seems to me that there's a little more autonomy with the captaincy role there, and that, yeah, and whatever decision he makes, the players are behind it. It's hard to get consensus on a topic. You can't even go to the grocery store and get consensus on what type of mustard you're going to buy. You know, I mean, there's just so many. And I feel like the U.S. team is always at loggerheads with getting proper consensus. And but it should be compelling. No doubt. It's like six picks. You know, is he going to go right down the list, or is he going to try to fill in gaps of things that he needs when he starts to look at different foursomes or four ball combinations of his players? So from that aspect, this will be the first time that a captain's had this many picks. And so I think from an analyst role, we'll be sitting on the desk trying to guess who he's going to pick, what gaps he's going to try to fill in, whether or not he's going to be playing favorites, whether or not there is, you know, an old boy, good old boy mentality to the picks, or is he's literally going to make the picks for the right combination. It's that great line in the movie Miracle. Herb Brooks, right? When he was told, these aren't the best players, he said, I don't want the best players. I want the right players. Yeah. And I thought that was just a great line. And it's like, who are the right players here? I think there's some mistakes that he could certainly make in making these picks. And, you know, I'll be curious to see if he avoids those mistakes, which will probably be, you know, tough decisions for him to make.
Yeah, I like the benevolent dictator model for the captain. Democracy, it seems like in small groups, can be more problematic than just a single leader being followed. But,
one of my favorite stories about that is, I won't name names, but I know a fellow who ran a club and was once questioned about his autonomy running a club and, you know, the board. And he said, well, I always felt like, you know, a board should be comprised of an odd number of people for obvious reasons. And then he said, and I always felt like three was just too many people.
There you go.
Somebody's got to make the decision. Yeah. I think that's with six picks, there's going to be more scrutiny to the picks than ever before at this Ryder Cup, you know, leading up to it, during it, and afterwards. So I think it'll be very compelling from that perspective.
And we'll have this wild card of the Bryson Brooks teammate situation, if they are teammates. So that adds another wrinkle of soap opera drama right now, which I guess makes the Ryder Cup even that much more interesting. I do want to say, by the way, that Vivian Player, 64 years married to Gary Player, passed away yesterday. Wonderful person. She'll be missed. Condolences to Gary and his whole family.
Well said.
Brandel, thanks so much. Always very provocative, all your thoughts. If there's any final takeaway you want to have?
I'd like to just add to that. You know, I was traveling yesterday, so, you know, I can't remember at what point along the road when I opened up my phone and saw that Vivian had passed away and read Gary Player's comments and how he fell in love with her at first sight at 14 years of age. You know, all the traveling he's done all over the world, you forget, you know, to make it in this game, it's such a such a brutal game, you know, in terms of sacrifices people make being away from their families. It's just so important to have a partner who understands what it is to be a professional golfer, and to hear about, I'd only ever met Vivian one time, but just to hear about what she meant to the world of golf and everybody she came in contact, it was, you know, it choked you up reading it. She lived a long, beautiful life, it sounded like, and, you know, it was, it certainly tugged at your heartstrings all day yesterday reading about that.
Yeah, well said, Randall. I mean, she was a lovely person and a rock for Gary, who you wouldn't expect needed a lot of, you know, sort of hard foundation under him because he's such a tough guy. But she was crucial to his success, and he was the first to say so. So thank you, Randall. Wonderful talking to you. We'll meet again next month.
Sounds good, Jaime. Enjoyed it. Talk to you later, my friend.
Okay, so long. Bye.